And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper returns tomorrow. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It was first observed in October 1987. Of course, that's tomorrow. So today we look at sexual violence and the new role that technology plays in this pervasive problem, which has received a lot of attention in recent weeks by the media. We have four guests in our studio. Joining us now is the founder and president of No More Tears, Somi Ali. Thanks for being with us again, Somi.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Barry University, Dr. Laura Finley. Laura also serves as the chair of the board of directors of No More Tears. Hi, Dr. Finley. Great to have you back.
Hi, thank you.
And in a few moments, we'll be joined by two victims of sexual assault or exploitation. But Somi, No More Tears seems to cut through much of the red tape in order to help victims of domestic violence, human trafficking. Tell us how that works and how you achieve that.
Well, many a time when a victim goes to a shelter, she has to fill out numerous amounts of paperwork, an entire packet, just to be able to obtain food. And No More Tears runs differently in that respect. We take pride in providing immediate assistance. So we have immigration attorneys, family law attorneys. We take them directly to Publix, get them food. If they need meds, some of them don't have health insurance, so we take them and get them medication. Some of the victims that we've assisted are HIV positive. They don't have money to get their medication. So we run differently in that respect. There's no waiting list at No More Tears. And when you're in dire need, you can't be told, come back in 2 months. We don't have room.
Right.
Or we don't have, you know, the funds or any facilities to help you at this point. So we run very, very differently in that respect. We understand, and someone that has grown up in a household of abuse, I know how important it is and how much of a difference a minute or a second can make.
Dr. Finley, I read your op-ed in the HuffingtonNews.net where you challenged the conventional shelter model of domestic violence services. Why?
Well, you know, I've had experience working with a more traditional domestic violence service and now with No More Tears for 7-8 years. And I just feel like while there's a need for shelter spaces and some of the services that are still provided by those organizations, and I mean this is no attack on any particular one, there's also much more need for a community response. And what I think No More Tears does well is more of a community response where we work together with a team of volunteers. Somi doesn't make any money. She takes no salary. No one does. It's just building a network of people so that when someone contacts us, what we can do is contact the right people. Like, okay, you need medical. All right, we know who to go to. Okay, you need a therapist. We know who to go to. We have them in multiple languages. And it's building that community network that I think is what is necessary and is working for us. And I think the traditional model ends up sometimes being more of a corporate model, because when you're seeking funding from grantors or major funders, you have to show sort of you're doing the same things, and we're putting people in beds, we're doing this many hours of service, and it becomes, I think, a little quantified and corporate, and sometimes that comes out as not very welcoming to victims. I don't think that's the intent, but I think it sometimes comes out that way, whereas if you're a little more flexible in your operations, you can be a little bit more intuitive to someone's needs, more responsive, as Somi was saying, and reduces that sort of corporate feel.
So it's more bureaucracy, is that what we're dealing with?
I think so, and I think that's largely related to the struggle for funding. When you operate a space, let's say it's a domestic violence shelter or some other kind of social service organization, and you have a space to cover the rent fees for and the utilities and all those things, and you have paid staff, and you have to count for all those things, you have to have some degree of bureaucracy, right? You have some paperwork that comes with grants that you have to file, or that makes you accountable to this kind of state funding, or you know, whatever it might be. Whereas if you operate as this sort of loose community collaboration like we do, you cut all that out.
But where do you get the funding to do that?
We're very creative. We have had some people who believe in what we're doing and give us small and larger donations. That's the bulk of what we do. We do small fundraisers. We have, you know, Support No More Tears for $10 a month campaign. People can do that for the price of 2 coffees a month, you know, just kind of grassroots organizing as well as grassroots fundraising.
And we're very transparent in where our funds go. So we break it down. It's everywhere on Facebook, Twitter, on our website, all our social media. Our supporters are like our family of No More Tears. We have two very big donors. The 5-Hour Energy Drink inventor, he donates to us. And then the Jacksonville Jaguars owner, who's actually from where I'm from, Pakistan, he's been supporting us for 3 years now. Outside of those two, we're significantly reliant on private donors. And we have a family of supporters that even if it's $10, $20 a month, it keeps us going. And we've been able to rescue over 1,000 victims since 2008, even though we haven't had a lot of money, but right. Somehow we survived.
You've done it. Well, I'd like to bring into the conversation now Dr. Holly Jacobs. Excuse me. She's the founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and the Campaign to End Revenge Porn. Hello, Dr. Jacobs. Glad to have you with us, too.
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you for having me.
Also with us, we welcome Bianca. She's an MSW student at Barry University. Both Bianca and Dr. Holly Jacobs have been victims and survivors of sexual assault or exploitation. Bianca, I'd like to begin with you. First, thanks for coming forward and making this public. Why do you want to talk about your experience here?
I think it's important for survivors to take stories and make some type of strength out of the story as opposed to holding on to their truth. It's important to be vocal about it for those that are silent.
So what do you want to say to others who have been afraid to speak up?
To speak up. It's important to help others. It's more instead of just an individual responsibility, but more of a human responsibility to speak your stories because your truth can help other people.
Well, you must be very brave. How difficult was it? Do you want to tell us what happened to you?
Yes. 9 years ago, I was visiting a friend, a guy that I was dating at the time on my birthday. And we got into an argument. I left the house. It was around midnight, a little past my curfew. So I intended to go to the gas station and ask to use the phone because I didn't have a cell phone. The attendant told me that he wasn't allowed to let customers use the phones. So he pointed me in a direction. I was really unfamiliar with the area. It was a very foreign area. I followed his directions. When I walked up the street, there was this dark car that just came out of nowhere, completely swept me off my feet. Everything happened so fast. There was a guy about my height that came with a gun to my face and told me to get into the car. When I got into the car, there was about maybe 6-7 other men just waiting to devour me in all kinds of ways. I was pistol whipped. I was beaten. I was raped. My clothes were ripped off. They took me all over town, took me to a gutter somewhere and had other friends rape me. After they were done with me, I was shoved out of a car somewhere in another foreign area that I was unfamiliar with. The gunman asked me to walk backwards. So that's when I thought my life was going to be over because I was assuming that, okay, he doesn't want me to identify him if I end up surviving. So I'm taking these steps backwards and all of a sudden the car just drives off. So I knock on a neighbor's door, you know, a neighbor's door that was there. I came and I asked them to help me because I was, you know, going through the situation. At first they were really hesitant to help because they didn't know what was going on, but eventually they took me in and my parents came to get me. I was taken to the Roxy Bolton Rape Treatment Center, treated there. 3 years later, there was justice served for one out of the several men that were the perpetrators of the crime.
So at this point, there's just one that's been apprehended.
That's
and
correct.
Serving
25 years.
25 years.
Yes.
Were you at any point made to feel as though you were the cause of your rape, that you were to blame somehow?
I did for a certain amount of time. But once I started to realize that there was nothing I could have did different, once I started to educate myself more on rape and what happens to victims, I started realizing that it had nothing to do with me. I think a lot of my blame for myself throughout the years had to do with the response that I got from teachers. Even though a lot of them were really supportive, a lot of them were very, what were you wearing? Why were you out that time of night so young? That was the kind of response I was getting.
What about the police?
When I came to the rape treatment, I was brought by the detective. There was a detective that brought me to the Roxy Bolton Rape Treatment Center, and his questions were even a little insulting. You know, where were you? You sure you didn't say you wanted to get in the car? Did you give them some type of, you know, sign that you were interested in getting a ride? You know, you didn't have a phone. Why didn't you have a phone? Again, why were you out this time of night in an area that you're not, you know, familiar with? Where are your parents? Looking back at that, yeah, the response I think was really blaming the victim in an indirect way. I don't think that's their intent, but the way they go about it just makes the victim feel like you did do something wrong. They asked me to see a therapist immediately after the event, which was a little overwhelming for me because, you know, you just went through this drastic situation and, oh, do you want to talk to somebody? No, I don't want to talk to someone. And I never got offered therapy ever again after that. There wasn't any follow-up services or, you know, anything of the sort to heal from the situation. A lot of my healing came from writing, advocating, speaking, assisting other nonprofit organizations that have the same initiative to help others speak out. That was the healing process for me, and being a social worker.
Which is what you're correct in the process of doing.
Yes.
Well, we're going to talk more about all the things you mentioned, and we're going to meet you, Dr. Holly Jacobs, in just a couple of minutes. We have to take a break. Our topic today is sexual violence and assault, and we're going to hear about a role that technology sometimes plays in the lack of legislation to deal with such abuse. We'll be right back. And thank you for joining us for today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper returns tomorrow. Our topic today is sexual violence and assault and the role that technology sometimes plays. We're visiting with Somi Ali, the founder and president of No More Tears. Dr. Laura Finley is an associate professor of sociology and criminology at Barry and the chair of the board of directors of No More Tears. Dr. Holly Jacobs is founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and the campaign to end revenge porn. And Bianca is an MSW student at Barry University and now an activist who advocates raising awareness about sexual assault. Sorry we didn't get to you before the break, Dr. Holly Jacobs. Let's turn to you now. You were the victim of revenge porn. For those who are unfamiliar with that, what is it?
So revenge porn refers to the distribution of nude or sexually explicit photos or videos without the consent of the subject. And we're seeing this a lot on the internet right now. And our organization actually, we prefer to call it non-consensual pornography because it's not always about getting revenge on the victim. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard about the case with the celebrities where hackers got into their iCloud accounts and stole their private photos and then posted them on the internet for everyone to see. That wasn't about revenge. That was about something else.
In your case, I realize you can't discuss your case in detail, but if you could tell us generally what happened.
So, yes, the reason that I started the organization and the End Revenge Porn campaign is because it happened to me. And basically, in my situation, private photos and explicit videos of me were posted all over the internet for everyone to see. And it had devastating repercussions on my life.
Tell us about that.
The material was posted under my full name, along with information about where I went to school, where I worked, and just everything about my life, my email address. And I had to leave my job. I had to go and defend myself to my dean and human resources at my school because the title of the video was actually professor at FIU and then my full name masturbates for her students. So the university thought that I might be some sort of sexual predator on campus. Mm. And it just affected every single aspect of my life to the point where I had to change my name to try to escape the effect that this could have on my professional life, and also to try to escape the harassment that I was enduring through emails from strangers that were looking at this material and trying to track me down. I mean, I became scared for my physical safety. I now carry around a 9mm because you just never know.
At the time of your experience, did you have any recourse, legal or otherwise? Did you contact the authorities?
I did everything that I could. I went to two different police stations in Miami, City of Miami and Miami-Dade Police. I went to the FBI, and the response that I got from them was, you know, well, you were over 18 when you took the photos, so it's not child pornography. And you gave them willingly to somebody, so technically they're that person's property and they could do whatever they wanted with it. And they all told me that I should go see a lawyer, that there were no criminal laws against this. I went through several lawyers and everybody helped me as much as they could, but essentially just threw their hands up in the air and said, you need to get your case picked up by the police. And I just kept bouncing back and forth.
So you'd go back to one and they would send you to the other? And
exactly. Everybody was just passing the bill, so to say.
Was there also victim blaming in your case?
It wasn't as direct as Bianca encountered, but in my case, you could just tell from the tone that people used when they spoke to me, like, you shared these photos willingly? Okay, well, go see a lawyer. This seems to be a spat between you and the person that you shared these photos with. But as we're helping other victims and speaking to other victims, there is definitely a lot of outright victim blaming there. A lot of police and officials telling the victims that they should have known better than to take photos like this in the first place. They should have known that they would end up on the internet and in the hands of somebody that they didn't expect them to be in.
Somi, you were saying during the break that you see a lot of this victim blaming and how a lot of the women who come to you are staying in abusive relationships because they're afraid of this revenge porn?
Absolutely. We've had numerous victims that, you know, consented to have photos and videos done when they were married or they were a couple, they had boyfriends. And once things went bad and there was abuse involved, when they decided to leave, the abuser would threaten them with releasing the photos or sending them to their families. Some of these women come from very conservative families. Sure. So that's always a fear. Some of them have, you know, Muslim backgrounds. And, you know, it's really, really sad because we had some women that actually almost lost their lives before they called the police because of this fear. And there's it's so sad because this victim blaming plays such a huge role in why women, you know, they can't leave. There's so many reasons. Like most of them, people that we work with are undocumented, so they're afraid of being deported. Then we have the photos, then we have the videos, and then they're threatened they can't see their kids ever again because they'll take the kids away. So
which
actually happened with one of our cases yesterday. And that's such a huge problem. And that goes to say why victims can't just get up and leave. I've heard officers come up to me and say, well, why couldn't she just leave? She's a woman from a different country, doesn't speak English at all, doesn't even know geographically where she is. She can't just get up and go. And she has kids and she's reliant on one single individual. And that's the abuser.
Dr. Finley, could you just give us an overview? What's going on now statistically? Are these figures just all on the upswing?
It's hard to know sometimes when you look at statistics because sometimes there might be a statistical increase, but it might be the function of actually reporting more versus actual more incidents.
Right.
However, the scope of these problems are still huge, regardless of its increase or decrease. You know, for instance, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, group known as RAIN, says a person, not necessarily a woman, but often a woman, is sexually assaulted in America every 2 minutes. That equals about 238,000 sexual assault victims annually. They say one in every six American women, approximately 3% of American men, because men too can be raped. And when you're looking at like college age, the risk is like one in four. These are sexual violence is a huge, huge problem. And I think what we were talking about earlier gets at some of the academic literature calls this rape myths. It's the victim blaming that everyone was speaking of, but they're myths or misconceptions about rape or sexual assault. And I think they play out with domestic violence as well. You know, this idea that women are prone to falsely reporting these things. Mm. Well, according to the FBI, that's not actually true. According to the FBI, no more than 8% and usually as low as 2% of sexual assault claims are false. That's lower than most every other crime. Yes, it happens. No, it's not common, you know?
The numbers you just cited, I'm assuming that many of these cases, if not a percentage, go unreported.
Yeah, the statistics say about 40% are reported of sexual assaults.
So we're talking about 60% more.
Yes, we really don't have a sense, you know? And college campuses, they say about 5% of incidents are reported. Oftentimes in those situations, because it's acquaintance related, and so that murkies the waters on the victim's end, not because it makes her responsible in any way, but because sometimes there was a relationship before, so they don't know, they don't want to call the authorities, or they don't know who to call sometimes, or they've also both been using drugs or alcohol, which makes the victim not at all responsible, but feel as though I will be in trouble if I report.
Right.
And we have to be careful about that language, because sometimes that language, even of if you're drinking, it's difficult, tells a victim, well, if I don't drink, it's okay. It's another victim blaming sometimes.
Exactly.
It's very careful navigation of saying, you know, this is a risk factor, but it's also a risk factor for perpetration. So let's talk about the perpetrators, or, you know, there are things that are risks on both sides.
Well, let's talk about that other article I read of yours that you wrote with your colleague Victor Romano, published in the Las Vegas Informer, entitled Sexual Assault is Men's Problem. And in it, you took to task an editorial by Dan K. Thomason entitled Academia Needs to Act to Protect College Women. So what is... You're saying instead of focusing on women's behavior, universities should be focusing on men's behavior.
Right. And too often, I think we do the easy thing, which is to say, protect yourself from being a would-be victim. So if you're a lady, don't walk alone, cover your drink at the bar, don't drink at all, preferably, always go places with friends, call the, you know, use the blue light box or whatever, you know, things directed at women to do what's called harm reduction or target hardening, usually. The problem with that is, crimes like rape are usually crimes of opportunity, and that's why so many of them are acquaintances, because you literally have an opportunity there. And so if I, as a would-be victim, harden myself as a target, okay, I don't drink, I don't go out, maybe I won't be a victim, but somebody else might be, because you didn't change the motivation of the offender in
right.
any way. You didn't target that person at all. And so our point, the op-ed that Dr. Romano and I wrote, was really saying that can be one component of educating a campus. A huge other component has to be about changing the social norms that create rape cultures, where, you know, groups of sometimes men say misogynistic things about women, act in ways that encourage sexual assault. I'm not saying all men do this by any stretch, but
right.
there are those cultures, and we're, I don't think, doing nearly enough to target those.
And what would you do?
Well, I think one thing we have to be careful of when we do that is not telling any man you're a would-be rapist, because that is not an effective approach.
And
right?
as you say, men also get raped.
And men also get raped. So let's talk about the issue of what does healthy sexual relationships look like. Let's talk about what does consent look like. Let's do that in an open, dialogical manner. Right now, there's some great initiatives that are getting going from the Obama administration. The White House has got It's On Us that was released, based on all the claims of universities not responding appropriately to sexual violence. Most people probably had seen in the news Emma Watson's speech before the United Nations with a He for She campaign, suggesting mm-hmm. that we aren't attacking men. We want men on our side, because our world will be a better place if sexual assault, domestic violence, and all these forms of gender-based violence were minimized, if not eradicated. We want you to help us do that. And most men do. That's the thing. I think most of the statistics on rape and sexual assault find that it's actually a very small percent of people perpetrating multiple assaults.
And even with the Ray Rice incident, was getting rid of him really resolving the problem, like suspending him? I mean, there needs to be, you know, the domestic violence training. And we reached out as an organization to Roger Goodell. We didn't hear back from him, but Laura does training. She's done training, domestic violence training with physicians and police officers and various other institutions. And that's something that we offer. So hating the men is not really going to resolve the issue. There needs to be education and getting them involved.
And to challenge those myths that we were talking about, that both Dr. Jacobs and Bianca said that they were victims of, that we so often see with our cases at No More Tears.
Would you say that all of the publicity that domestic abuse, at least, is getting right now with, you know, for example, the NFL, is a good thing?
It's an upside.
During the Dolphin game last Sunday, there were a few ads on for domestic abuse awareness. Did you see that?
There's an organization called No More, actually.
And it's all these men saying there's no excuse.
Right.
There's no excuse.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's what we need. I mean, that's the silver lining.
And I'd like to add to that, too, just to reiterate the point. These are problems that do impact men, either as victims or as members of a community who have sisters, daughters, loved ones that are women that they don't want to see happening. You know, while the NFL has gotten a lot of attention lately, these are problems that are true outside of the NFL. And in fact, we have U.S. national soccer player Hope Solo, who was arrested for domestic violence. And I think we should pay equal attention to those kinds of cases. And how has U.S. national soccer continued to allow her to play while the NFL came under heat for allowing Ray Rice to play?
Right.
You know, so I think we have to be fair to both sides there and say it's a problem. It's not a problem just when men do it.
It's Topical Currents. Our topic is sexual violence, domestic violence, assault, and the role that technology sometimes plays. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. It's Topical Currents. Thank you so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman with you. We're with Samui Ali, the founder and president of No More Tears. Dr. Laura Finley, associate professor of sociology and criminology at Berry and chair of the board of directors of No More Tears. Dr. Holly Jacobs is founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and the campaign to end revenge porn, which we're going to talk more about. And Bianca is an MSW student at Berry University and now an activist. And I was thinking, Bianca, when did you become, instead of a victim of, you know, this horrible crime, to someone who could help and reach out and advocate for others? Was there a turning point for you?
The turning point started, I would say, almost immediately. I knew I was different when I was more concerned about what the perpetrators were doing to other people more than what was happening to me. As far as who else they were hurting, who else they were raping, who else were they kidnapping, because it was a constellation of events that happened that night. I was kidnapped, I was beaten, I was raped. There was a lot of things that happened. So I knew that turning point started for me when I was home just wondering, what am I going to do? I have to tell other people what's happening. I have to go and I have to advocate. I have to go and tell my story. I have to save other women. I have to, especially around my age. It happened on my 18th birthday. So my target was really more towards, you know, young adult woman like myself, and letting them know that this is what's happening. What can we do to stop this problem?
So how are you advocating? I know you're advocating for an end to a backlog on rape kits. First, if you could tell us what the rape kit is. I mean, it's self-evident. It is a kit after you're raped, if you would just explain that.
Yes, it's a kit that it's administered after you're raped, which can be a little intrusive and a little overwhelming for most victims, but unfortunately it's something that has to be done after rape for the collection of evidence and accuracy. It's taken from your body, sperm, hair follicles, anything that can be found on the victim. So you're coming from an individual to basically a crime scene in a matter of minutes, especially if you go right in the way I did. So the evidence is taken, put into a kit, and the kit is sent to the crime labs. The crime lab keeps them sometimes for years because they don't have any evidence, they don't follow up, they're overwhelmed with how many rape kits they're receiving. There has been several initiatives that has been going on, and from what I've been seeing, there's the Department of Justice has been pretty receiving of tackling the problem and allocating money to address the issue with that so far from what I've been seeing.
Anything else you're doing?
Yes, I currently have a research project that was just approved by my university that I'm actually conducting with Dr. Finley regarding the experience of undergraduate students who experienced crimes and what happened when they did report it. What was the sensitivity? Was there any insensitivity? Mm-hmm. Things of that nature. Was it followed up? Did you get called back? Did you receive any therapeutic services? Was there an advocate on the case? My ultimate goal, my vision with that is to get crimes that are underreported or reported to be addressed properly through proper training, more trauma-informed training, public safety officers who are more sensitive to the issue, who know what's going on. Again, that goes back to victim blaming. I really don't think a lot of the officials that are involved with first response are doing it intentionally. It's just because that's just
what they know.
What they know, exactly. So I think if we as clinicians and social workers and psychologists and nonprofit organization leaders would train them on what's going on, they would be more receptive to offering that sensitivity back to victims. And it's more effective and more likely for victims to report. So I figured we can do this research project and find out what we, you know, see what we come up with.
Right.
Could I add to that a little, Bonnie, for just
yeah,
a quick
sure.
second? You know, we're really excited to be able to do this research, which we got our Institutional Review Board approval pending a couple quick changes that are happening this week. So this is a big, I mean, it's an important thing for a university to recognize. There's a need to study this, study what students may have experienced and how they may experience that response. And I think that's just important to acknowledge that it's also consistent with what the White House is recommending, that universities take a look inside of what's going on. What are students at your place experiencing? How do they experience justice if they get it at all? Is there some sensitivity that can be happening? How do we change the climate? How do we reduce some of those rape myths or victim blaming that really call the importance also on why we need the rape kit backlog to end, because oftentimes when those myths surround crimes like this, the only evidence that's going to be considered credible
is
the physical evidence. And if those are sitting in a warehouse somewhere not getting analyzed, that's really hard for a victim to ever get any sense of justice, closure, or even help.
Or don't they have to be in a certain temperature to...
Yeah, I believe there's probably conditions that they need to be kept under, and I can't speak to all the specifics of that, but
right.
I do agree with Bianca that it looks like the Department of Justice has put some priority on this because there were some scandalous reports from all over the country that were released a year or so ago, and thankful for that attention to a really important issue.
Dr. Jacobs, I want you to, if you would, tell us about the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and the campaign to end revenge porn. You founded both these organizations now.
Yeah, so it's actually just one organization.
Oh, okay.
The Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is the nonprofit, and End Revenge Porn is our first campaign.
I see. Okay.
So, I know, it gets a little confusing.
That's okay.
But basically, because I was a victim of this, because I kept getting bounced around from one authority to another, and I realized that there weren't any other organizations out there to help victims like myself, I decided to start my own. And I decided that I wanted this organization to have everything that I needed when I was a victim of this. And one of the first
that
things
you didn't get.
That I didn't get, right. One of the first things that I realized I needed was for the laws to change, was for police to be picking up these cases, because at the time, I was a PhD student. I was living off of student loans, and I certainly did not have hundreds of thousands of dollars to hire an attorney like the law enforcement was telling me to. So that's one of the first things that I decided needed to be changed, was we need to have criminal laws in place to address this issue. And then it just sort of grew from there. I thought, okay, victims need support. They need a place to go where they can talk to somebody who can help to guide them through the psychological effects that this has on a person. Some of them will need some attorneys that can represent them pro bono or lo bono. And actually, on that note, I wanted to say that we're working closely with a pro bono legal project that just launched on Friday called the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project. Mm. And it's
an international firm?
So yes, it's actually run, it's being launched by an international firm, K&L Gates, who has offices all over the world, and they also have their own computer forensics team. So not only do you have very motivated, passionate attorneys willing to help victims, but you also have a forensics team that can do the evidence gathering that so many authorities can't do right now because it's just such a new issue. And in addition to that, we're working on tech solutions to help victims get their material off of the internet. Mm. And for those victims who have pictures or videos hosted on international sites who refuse to take the material down, then we're also working on coming up with a tool or system to help them just push the results down in the search results of their name so that it doesn't affect their professional future. Among other things, just everything that I could think of, I was like, let's do it.
And how are you being funded?
That's a good question. So up to this point, I've been funding the organization myself just out of pocket. And also we've received a few small donations through our website. EndRevengePorn.org is for the campaign and CyberCivilRights.org is for the organization. But for the most part, we are in desperate need of major donors.
Are you a not-for-profit yet? Have you applied for that status or?
So we are a non-for-profit, but we don't have our 501c3 status just yet.
Okay.
But we have a fiscal sponsor, so we are able to bring in tax-deductible donations. So I knew we had to have something in place in the meantime while we wait for the IRS to review our paperwork and approve us.
Do you think this issue is receiving enough attention?
I think that it's definitely starting to. When I first launched the campaign, there were virtually no articles on this issue. One would pop up every couple weeks. And now there are so many popping up and so many news reports on this issue that I can't even keep up myself and also do the work that I'm doing. So I'm thrilled to see that it's finally getting the attention that it so needs. But people still need to talk about this and spread awareness. And that's another aspect of our organization. We're really trying to spread the word and make people aware that it's a new form of sexual abuse. And you heard from Somi that it's being used in cases of domestic violence. And also it's also being used in human trafficking to keep the victims in human trafficking, threatening them that we have photos of you doing this. These acts, we have videos of you. If you leave, we will release this to your family, your friends.
Absolutely. It's extremely prevalent when it comes to human trafficking. That's the number one tool because many of these girls are like girls from good families, good religious families, conservative families, and they're terrified.
Right.
Our topic today is sexual violence, sexual assault, domestic violence, the role that technology sometimes plays in all this, and a lack of legislation to deal with the abuse. We're going to take our last break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Dr. Laura Finley, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Barry University. Somi Ali, the founder and president of No More Tears, Bianca, an MSW student at Barry University and now an activist. Who advocates raising awareness about sexual assault. And Dr. Holly Jacobs is founder of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, and the campaign to end revenge porn is their first campaign.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it right.
We had a tweet. Our computer is down, but Paul just told me on revenge porn, they asked if copyright laws apply. Does the person who took the picture own the picture? Dr.
Yes.
Jacobs?
Yes. So that's something that we're suggesting that victims do is actually use copyright takedown notices to get their material down. So yes, if they take the photo themselves, they own the copyright to it. They have to register for the copyright through the copyright office before they file the paperwork with the website. But that does help them to get some of the material down.
So what about the abusive person? If they took the photos, then they own them?
It's actually kind of a complicated question because we're
okay.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert on
right.
that, but there may be a way to argue for like co-copyright of it, but in general, if somebody else took the photo, then no, you don't you it's very difficult to get the material down.
Right. Dr. Finley, we were talking about abuse, sexual abuse in the military, which you said, can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, you know, I mean, again, I've not been a military member, so I know this academically, but this is another huge scandal that has broken in the last couple of years of how frequently women experience sexual assault and domestic violence in the military, and the unique challenges that poses for reporting, because oftentimes military bases are very small kind of communities that may have some resources or very minimal resources. But people know everyone. And so that's one of the huge things that's emerged is if you are a victim of a sexual assault or domestic violence, how do you go somewhere and be guaranteed any safety and anonymity when it's this very small sort of tight network
right.
of people? And then sort of the hierarchy of military, if you yourself are a military member, a woman in the military who's experienced sexual assault, if you report on your superior, who is maybe your assailant,
right.
How does that impact you? There's a great documentary called Invisible War that you can actually watch online if you navigate successfully through the YouTubing. It's fantastic. That really highlights the scope of this problem. But I think what it also gets at is the bigger problems we've been talking about today. They're not exclusive to military. They're issues of when you have sort of hierarchical, male-dominated, sort of aggression-emphasized cultures, you are amping up the risk factors for domestic violence and sexual assault. That doesn't mean there will always be there, but it's just a layer after layer of difficulty and again, a factor that makes it more likely that a sexual assault or a domestic violence incident will happen. We had one case that we heard about from No More Tears that contacted us from outside of the state, and she was married to a military man.
Oh, yeah.
And the abuse that this woman endured was sexual, physical, and everything else you can imagine. And her difficulty in getting free of him is amazing. He knows everything. He's very well connected. There's no one she can report to, even medical officials who he does not know. I mean, it's just, again, layers of difficulty in certain institutional settings.
Somi Ali, you've expanded your mission and mm-hmm. your services quite a bit. I guess you did that in January. Tell us all the things you're doing right now at No More Tears.
So we started with domestic violence, then we diversified and we veered into human trafficking. We're actually now working with the FBI. We just partnered with them last month because human trafficking is extremely prevalent in South Florida. And then we didn't want to have like this rigid mission. We believe in helping anyone and everyone that needs help. And of course, if we have the funds to do so.
Right.
So we decided to work with immigrant parents that bring their children here for medical treatment. And the first child that we assisted had cerebral palsy. And he's about 6 years old now. He's doing very well. So we implemented that. And they, of course, need immigration attorneys so they can stay here. And we contacted doctors. And so we incorporated, one, that. And then, two, having been from, you know, I was born in Pakistan. So I felt like I wanted to do something for the children in Pakistan. And I realized that it's only $82 to give a blind child eyesight. Mm. I couldn't believe it was just $82 for surgery. So thus far, No More Tears has done 18 surgeries. So 18 children are now able to see.
In Pakistan
because of our organization. We're doing the scholarship fund that Laura actually came up with.
The No More Tears Scholarship Fund.
The No More Tears Scholarship Fund. And we have a recipient sitting right here. That's Bianca. We just helped her get through her grad school. And where there was...
The school in India.
Oh, the school in India. That was my dream, to build a school in a village. So
Pakistan? Oh,
in India. India, yeah.
Okay.
Let's address each country eventually.
Yeah, right.
But it's a $70,000 project. We can't fund the whole thing because we don't have the funds. But we decided to fund it 5 to 10%. And it's for underprivileged children that are not allowed to go to school. They don't have the funds. And it's in this small village in India. So I'm really excited about that. I'm going to go in January. Hopefully Laura will join me. And we're going to lay the first brick.
Wow. Let me ask you, just give us a little of your background. I know you're from Pakistan. What events or circumstances inspired you to start No More Tears?
Well, my mother's from Iraq. My father's from Pakistan. And I grew up, I was born in Pakistan. I came here when I was 12. But I experienced a lot of sexual and physical abuse myself as a child. And my mother was a victim of abuse. And when I moved to the U.S. when I was 12 years old, I actually was a victim of a brutal rape. And I had just moved here, so it was devastating. But in hopes of finding a silver lining to all that I encountered, that's why I decided to start No More Tears.
Did you want to add something before, Holly?
Just on the copyright answer, I reached out to one of my experts, and you don't have co-ownership of the copyright, but you do have some rights to the picture. But the problem with going after copyright is that, again, you need an attorney to pick up the case.
Right, you need the money to hire an attorney.
Exactly. And so that's why we're pushing for criminal legislation, because we're trying to stop this behavior before it starts, to prevent it from happening in the first place. Because once those pictures come up or go up, they are very, very difficult to get down.
Yeah, I've heard it's virtually impossible.
Yeah, well, we're trying to change that. But right now, it's proving to be very difficult to get the pictures down completely. Some of mine are still out there, even though I have a takedown service that's daily working to get it down.
Bianca, did you want to add anything? We're getting close to the end of the show, and I saw you kind of shaking your head before about something we were saying.
No, just want to mention about the incapacitation of some victims. That's usually the target for some of the perpetrators.
Okay.
And what I mean by incapacitation is maybe under some type of influence of drugs, or passed out, or drunk. A lot of the times, going back to what Dr. Finley said in the beginning, that tends to be some of the reasons why they don't want to report what's underreported, because they think they'd be in trouble. So it goes back to them again.
Right.
So that's it. I just wanted to add that as some of the targets that some of the perpetrators look for, so that way they're not liable for any of their actions.
Is there any chance of them catching the rest of the perpetrators in your crime? I mean, it was 9 years ago.
He refused to give up the rest of the names. He took me to court.
He took you to court?
Well, he didn't take me to court, but he requested a trial. He did not want to take the plea bargain, even though there was evidence against him on DNA that was found in my rape kit. I don't know what the probability is that they would find anybody else.
Well, I'm very glad all of you came in. In the last couple of minutes here, or last couple of seconds, I want to get contact information. Somi Ali, the founder and president of No More Tears, your website.
It's nomoretearsproject.org.
And that's No More Tears Project, not NMT.
It's both. It's okay. NMTproject.org or NoMoreTearsProject.org.
And your crisis hotline number?
It's 954-324-7669.
And we'll have this on our website, these links.
Perfect.
Okay. And Dr. Laura Finley, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Barry University and the Chair of the Board of Directors of No More Tears, thank you so much for being with us. Is there any website you...
No, folks, if folks want to follow up with me, they can find me either on the No More Tears website or at Barry University's website in the Department of Sociology and Criminology. And I thank you for the opportunity. I think this is such an important issue, and I think just hopefully laid a foundation for people to start talking more about these things.
And
there's
to do
so much more.
Okay, and Dr. Holly Jacobs, the cybercivilrights.org and endrevengeporn.org.
Correct. And then people can also follow us on Twitter at the handle @EndRevengePorn or @CCRInitiative.
And Bianca, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is wonderful.
Our producers, Richard Ives, technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary, and Joseph Cooper returns tomorrow with the South Florida History Quiz with Dr. Paul George. Bonnie Berman thanking you for joining us.